protest has to stop. People are put out of work, communities suffer, and it may be in 10, 20, or 30 years we discover that logging was not a danger to the spotted owl, or may remain contentious. My point here is that the drama surrounding such disputes, angry marches and press coverage, tree hugging and bulldozers, serves to obscure the deeper problem. We don't know how to manage the environment, even when there is no conflict at all. To see why, let's take a case history of our management of the environment, Yellowstone National Park. Long recognized as a place of great natural beauty, in 1872, Ulysses Grant set aside Yellowstone as the first formal nature preserve in the world. It's more than 2 million acres, larger than Delaware and Rhode Island combined. John Muir was delighted when he visited in 1885, noting that under the care of the Department of the Interior, Yellowstone was protected from, quote, the blind, ruthless destruction that is going on in adjoining regions. Theodore Roosevelt was also pleased in 1903 when he went to Yellowstone National Park for a dedication ceremony. Here he is. This was his third visit. Roosevelt saw 1,000 antelope, plentiful cougar, mountain sheep, deer, coyote, and many thousands of elk. He wrote, quote, "Our people should see to it that this rich heritage is preserved for their children and their children's children forever, with its majestic beauty all unmarred." But Yellowstone wasn't preserved. On the contrary, it was altered beyond repair in a matter of years. By 1934, the Park Service acknowledged that white-tailed deer, cougar, lynx, wolf, and possibly wolverine and fisher are gone from the Yellowstone fauna. What they didn't say was that the Park Service was solely responsible for the disappearances. Park rangers had been shooting the animals for decades, even though that was illegal ever since the Lacey Act of 1894. But the rangers thought they knew best. They thought their environmental concerns trumped any mere law. What actually happened in Yellowstone is a cascade of ego and error. But to understand it, we have to go back to the 1890s. Back then, it was believed that elk were becoming extinct, and so these animals were fed and encouraged. Over the next few years, the number of elk in the park exploded. Roosevelt had seen a few thousand animals and had noted that they were more numerous than his last visit. They were because a great deal of care was taken to see that they were fed. By 1912, there were 30,000 elk. By 1914, there were 35,000. Things were seen to be going very well. Rainbow trout had also been introduced, and though they crowded out the native cutthroats, nobody really worried. Fishing was great, and bears were increasing in numbers, and moose and bison. By 1915, Roosevelt realized that the elk had become a problem, and he urged scientific management, which meant culling. His advice was ignored. Instead, the Park Service did everything they could to increase their numbers. The results were predictable. First, antelope and deer began to decline. Overgrazing changed the flora. Aspen and willows were being eaten and did not regenerate. In an effort to stem the loss of animals, the park rangers began to kill predators, which they did without public knowledge. This is a man in 1927 with a wolf cub. It's a very cute picture, but the reason why he has the wolf cubs is they were going into the dens and killing all the animals. Here's a dead cougar, 1927 again. They eliminated the wolf and the cougar, and they were well on their way to getting rid of the coyote. Then a national scandal broke out, and studies showed that it wasn't predators that were killing the other animals. After all, it was overgrazing from too many elk. The management policy of killing predators had only made things worse. To give you a sense about this, the elk ate so many aspen that you now see these small stands, as you see here, protected by a kind of a barrier to keep the animals out. The aspen was very, very plentiful in Yellowstone. Now, when the aspen were consumed, the beaver left. because the beaver needed us in the time of dams. And they disappear. Beaver are essential to the water management of the park. Without dams, the meadow dried hard in summer, and still more animals vanished. The situation worsened. It became increasingly inconvenient that all the predators had been killed off by 1930. So in the 1960s, there was a sigh of relief when new sightings by rangers suggested that wolves were returning. There were also persistent rumors that the rangers were trucking them in. But in any case, the wolves of the 1960s vanished soon after. They needed to eat beaver and other small rodents, and those animals were gone. Pretty soon, the Park Service initiated a PR campaign to prove that excessive elk were not responsible for the problems in the park, even though they were. The campaign went on for about a decade, during which time the bighorn sheep virtually disappeared. Now we're in the 1970s, and bears were starting to be recognized as a growing problem. They used to be considered fun-loving creatures, and their close association with human beings was encouraged within the park. Here's a bear feeding that people used to watch them. And I think this still went on. I think I saw this as a kid in the 1950s. Here's a postcard from the 1930s. How things were in Yosemite. Setting the table for bears at Lake Camp Yosemite Park. You see, they have very good table manners. But now it seemed that there were more bears and certainly many more lawyers in the United States, and thus more threat of litigation. So the rangers moved the grizzlies away. The grizzlies promptly became endangered. Their formerly growing numbers shrank. Park Service refused to let scientists study them, but once the grizzlies were declared endangered, then the scientists could go in and study them. And by now, we're about ready to reap the rewards of our 40-year policy of fire suppression and smoking the bear and all of that. The Indians used to burn forest regularly, and lightning caused natural fires every year. But when these are suppressed, branches drop off trees to the ground over the years, and that makes for a very hot, low fire that sterilizes the soil. And in 1988, Yellowstone burned. In all, 1.2 million acres were scorched, and 800,000 acres, one-third of the park, burned. Then, having killed all the wolves, having tried to sneak them back in, they officially brought the wolves back, and now the local ranchers screamed. But the wolves seemed to be eating enough of the elk, so that slowly the ecology of the park was being restored. Or so it was claimed, as it had been claimed before, and on and on and on. As the story unfolds, it becomes impossible to overlook the cold truth that when it comes to managing 2.2 million acres of wilderness, nobody since the Indians has had the faintest idea how to do it. And nobody asked the Indians, because the Indians managed the land very aggressively and very intrusively. The Indians started fires regularly. They burned trees and grasses. They hunted the large animals, elk and moose, to the edge of extinction in the Yellowstone, which was the hunting ground of a number of tribes. These were Shoshone. White men refused to do that, and they made things worse. To solve our embarrassment, everybody pretended that the Indians had never altered the landscape. Quite the contrary, these pioneer ecologists, as Stuart Udall called them, did not manipulate the land, we were told. But now academic opinion is shifting again, and the wisdom of Indian land management policies is being discovered anew. Now,